Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is Tuesday, June 25th, 2019. We have six cases on our calendar for today, three of which are for oral argument. First of which is A18-2097. Abu Zeni, is that how you pronounce it?
Yes, Your Honor.
Abu Zeni versus Mushler.
Okay.
I got them both right. How about that? That's our first case for oral argument. Attorney for appellant, I understand there's only going to be one person arguing, correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay. And you'll have 15 minutes for your initial arguments, followed by 15 minutes by respondent, and then 5 minutes for rebuttal if you so choose. When you approach the podium, there's a button underneath if you want to raise and lower it. Please state your name for the record and the party you're representing. And with that, you may begin, counsel.
Your Honor, I'm Sean Perry, and I represent all of the plaintiffs with the exception of Cheryl Mutchler, who is represented by Mr. Stephenson, who is at counsel table with me. We're co-appellants in this case. Our plaintiff group, or appellant group in this case, consists of 35 plaintiffs. We have 31 individuals, four entities, that are fractional owners of 25 entities. We have named 21 defendants, three of whom we've labeled as culpable defendants. Those are the parties against whom the relief is directed. The other defendants were joined so that all of the owners of all of the entities were before the court, because the remedy we were seeking in the trial court was equitable relief in the form of forced buyouts, forced sales, or dissolution. No claims for money damages. So we thought it important to join all of the parties that had ownership interest in the companies. What this case is, Your Honors, is an attempt to get out of a bad relationship for our clients. We are trying to simply disassociate, get bought out, sold, or dissolve companies so that we, our people, can effectively get what we have colloquially referred to as a business divorce. We expressly and made it really clear through the amended complaint that there is no claim for any monetary relief under any of the legal theories asserted in these claims. It's simply these claims are to dissociate and get divorced out of a bad relationship. The facts underline the claims, the triggers for the equitable relief that we're seeking consist of basically two broad categories of claims. One category are claims that couldn't possibly be derivative. The other category is claims that are potentially derivative if money damages are claimed. And those two classes consist of essentially deadlock. So the first category, we've asserted claims for deadlock, ownership disputes, clarification of who owns what, and whether transfers of ownership were properly documented, for breaches, multiple breaches of governance documents, whether they be bylaws, whether they be resolutions, other governance documents, shareholder agreements, member control agreements, partnership agreements. Those categories of claims, Your Honors, we assert can't possibly be derivative because our clients are trying to assert direct rights they have under these governance arrangements.
But counsel, the Medtronic test is a two-part test that we look at. We look at who suffered the injury and who receives the benefit of a recovery. So how the relief is styled is immaterial to that analysis.
Your Honor, I respectfully disagree with that conclusion, and here's why. Is the second prong of the Medtronic test, who gets the recovery, has to relate to what the nature of the recovery is. So if the recovery, if you have an injury, regardless of how the claim is styled, obviously, any plaintiff has to have some injury to have standing to bring the claim in the first place. And the injury can be direct or indirect. When you're dealing with claims that sound and waste and misappropriation at the core, that clearly presents derivative claims if somebody is suing for a recovery of money or a recovery of assets. The cases make that really clear. That
because part's the loss is experienced by the entity. I mean, that's the allegation and that kind of a waste of corporate assets. It seems to me your strongest argument that that the claims of your clients are direct would be the claims under 302A. 751, where you're asserting at least the claim for relief under that statute of a forced buyout or the like. What factual allegations? That's where I'm struggling when I look at your First Amendment complaint. What are the factual allegations that support count 9?
We have allegations of deadlock. We have allegations of breaches of governance documents. And breaches of governance documents, as Your Honor knows from the Lund versus Lund case, is, and those can be, of course, written documents, and they can be oral agreements insofar as what are the reasonable expectations of the shareholders. You know,
I know about the Lund case, and that's what I'm wondering, which of the allegations in paragraph 11 would support recovery under 302A.751?
I submit that all of them do, Your Honor. And the reason we're suggesting that, even the claims for waste and misappropriation, because 302A751, in this case, really 322B, 833, there are more LLCs than there are corporations here. But the test is the same.
Right.
If the triggers for equitable relief can be unfairly prejudicial conduct, fraud, misrepresentation, and under unfairly prejudicial conduct, you get into the reasonable expectations doctrine under the statutes that say that, you know, reasonable expectations is a species, basically, of unfairly prejudicial conduct. So if this were...
It doesn't have to be tied to a particular shareholder under those statutes. I mean, and as I review the allegations in paragraph 11, for example, sub A, misappropriating and converting dollars from the entities, it seems to suggest that the relief is going to inure to the entities, the same as sub B, failing to properly, accurately document ownership interests, again, relates to the entities, as do many of the factual allegations. That's what I'm struggling with.
Well, Your Honor, if there was a claim, if the Supreme Court precedent talks about the party who's asking for the remedy in the context of who is going to recover, if there's that, and it talks about recovering the misappropriated money, I will concede that a lot of the injury that our clients suffered was through this cookie jar commingling and self-dealing. But if we're not asking to recover that money, if we're not asking to recover any misappropriated assets, prong two of the test, of the Medtronic test, is not satisfied to show that that claim is derivative. That's our position.
But what the Supreme Court said in Medtronic is they styled it as to whom any recovery is owed. In other words, who would be entitled to a recovery?
Yeah, or belongs. It uses the phrase "who to whom the recovery belongs" as well.
Right.
So, Your Honor, if we are suing for a forced buyout, there is no recovery. We're just trying to separate. And the statutes allow that. Common law allowed that before the statutes were in effect. So that's the conduct can be a trigger for the so-called business divorce. And that is where our claim is grounded.
But how do you get around the injury part? Because as noted, it seems to go to the entities. So seems like the injury would be to the entities themselves.
Not all of the injuries. So, for example, we have alleged that these contracts, these governance documents have been breached.
Which ones, though?
Resolutions, bylaws. They're generally...
Resolutions aren't agreements.
But they're... If you look, Your Honor, at the Lund case, which was recently decided, there are oral promises and emails and things like that to allow somebody to exit an illiquid position.
My recollection of that case, though, is that the pleadings were more specific as to what were the claimed oral agreements that were breached than what I see here.
That case was decided post-trial, too, Your Honor. This is a Rule 12 motion.
I understand that.
And, you know, we strongly believe that notice pleading is applicable to our claims and that we clearly met the notice pleading standard. We also asked the court to allow us to provide more specificity if the court thought it was
right,
lacking.
But the court did that to a certain extent by allowing your amended complaint. So why wasn't that done when the complaint was amended? That seems like it would have been a perfect opportunity to identify what particular contracts or agreements we're talking about. Are we talking about a shareholder agreement? Are we talking about a joint venture agreement? Are we talking about bylaws? What are the agreements and what part of those agreements has been breached? There's an allegation, for example, of breach of those contracts, and then other types of relief related to the breach. But how do you know what to reform if you don't even know what contract or contracts you're talking about?
So how to
reform them?
Yeah, Your Honor, we have a fairly lengthy complaint. It could have been 100 or 200 pages, given the nature of this case. We said if the court has any concerns about vagueness, we will be happy to beef it up, so to speak. And we had hundreds and hundreds of pages of materials filed for the injunction motion. We could have and would have done that. We didn't think it was necessary because of Rule 8 and the U.S. Bank versus Walsh standard that recently clarified that all you do is need to give notice. We pointed out in our appellate brief that the defendants, in challenging the injunction motion, raised 7 or 11 factual areas that they wanted to dispute to challenge the injunction motion. They know what the claims are that we are asserting.
Right, but if you're alleging a breach of contract, it seems common sense that you'd have to identify at least what contract you're talking about that is being breached. If you want reformation of a contract, well, what provision or provisions are you talking about that need to be reformed?
And, Your Honor, if that's a failure to plead, and if the court thinks so, the trial court thought so, and Your Honors think so, the remedy is to dismiss the case without prejudice or allow a more definite statement. And we offered to do that. We didn't think it was necessary. We offered it twice in the district court. And the U.S. Bank versus Walsh makes it clear that a dismissal with prejudice at a Rule 12 stage, and especially in a case like this, is just inappropriate.
Well, why is it inappropriate unless there are facts that are in dispute in terms of, I mean, we just look at what the complaint says.
Right,
but we're looking at the amended complaint.
All we need to do to state a claim, we don't even have to recite the elements of a contract claim under U.S. Bank versus Walsh to state a claim. You can basically say there was a breach of contract.
You can just say that you can allege merely that there is a contract and the other party breached it.
Yeah, and we identified categories of contracts, and I concede, Your Honor, we did not plead, for example, that the member control agreement for Central Midway LLC was breached, and here's how it was breached. We could have. And we're prepared to do that on a remand if the court believes that that's appropriate. But this is a notice pleading state. And I'll concede the reformation claim may require more specificity. That is a sub claim and basically a species or effectively a remedy tied to the overall breach of contract claim that was asserted. But ultimately, Your Honor, the reasonable expectations doctrine, frustration of reasonable expectations, which is a subcategory of unfairly prejudicial conduct to trigger the right to a forced buyout or a forced sale or a dissolution, doesn't have to be pled with specificity. And those aren't fraud claims. They're just simply breach of contract type animals. And the courts have clearly said that Rule 8.
While you're on the subject of breach of contract, isn't the remedy a legal remedy versus an equitable remedy, which is what you're alleging all your claims are?
It can be both, Your Honor. So it can be both a trigger or a predicate act under the oppression statutes, whether they're the Limited Partnership Act, the LLC Act, or the Business Corporation Act. But even a traditional breach of contract claim, sometimes specific performance can be awarded. That's one of the remedies we ask for. And that ties to the ownership issues in some of these companies, where they were improperly documented after transfers and things like that. I see my time's up.
Yep.
So any other questions at this point?
I don't see any. And you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Counsel for respondent.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Brad Lindemann. I'm here on behalf of defendants John J. Mutchler, James Wagner, and JGM Properties. I also represent a number of the nominal defendants, but they are not involved in this particular appeal. I think that the issues before the court are limited, and the question really is if an injury is occurring at the corporate level, but the remedy sought is purely equitable, does that take the claim outside of the requirements of the derivative pleading requirement of 23.09? And we don't have to look far for an answer to that question. The Minnesota Supreme Court answered that question in 1999 in the Wesson case, where they specifically held that the derivative pleading requirements apply to claims brought under 302A.751. And notably in that case, there were four counts alleged. Two of those counts, and they're count two and count three, identified in the Wesson case, sought purely equitable relief. The court essentially explained that the remedies within the organizational statutes, and I say organizational statutes because here we have corporations and LLCs and limited partnerships, but essentially the remedial statutes are identical. The Minnesota Supreme Court explained that those remedial statutes do not supplant the pleading requirements of Rule 23.09.
Well, that might be a general case. Drawn to the fact that a couple of the claims are for very much, it seems to me, individualized direct relief. The forced buyout isn't something you're doing on behalf of the entity. It is what a shareholder or a member of an LLC is doing to say, my expectations haven't been met, I want out of this thing. That seems to me to be a direct, not derivative claim. Why am I wrong about that?
Well, that's a remedy. But the damage pleaded in the complaint all is occurring at the corporate level. They essentially sound in waste and misappropriation. And the fact that the plaintiff in this case has selected to cast their claim as foregoing any right for the corporation to collect damages and instead simply seeking buyout, again, is a choice of remedy. It does not change the claim, and that actually...
Aren't all the claims under 302A751 subdivision 1B of the sort you're talking about?
Well...
They're always going to be that.
Not necessarily, and the Wesson case explains that, and at 465 of the Wesson case, they describe how those statutes are intended to provide a remedy in cases of corporate freeze-out or oppression. In other words, where a shareholder is treated differently than other shareholders, those statutes provide a mechanism for the shareholder to get out of the company.
Well, they've certainly pleaded that. They've claimed that the culpable, I can't remember the term, culpable defendants have treated themselves differently and more favorably than them.
They have not pleaded that. All of the damage that is pleaded in this case has to do with claims that affected all of the shareholders equally. The damage is occurring at the corporate level, and Wesson and the Medtronic case from 2017 describe those types of claims in the context of a 302.
So you think they pleaded that they were treated the same with the cookie jar proceeds as the people who were receiving the benefit of the cookie jar proceeds?
That is correct. Now, the cookie jar, the CJ fund, is a little complicated, and that has to do with the pleadings here, too, because we're not dealing with a single entity. What's happened factually is there are a number of different entities, and the commingling alleged by the plaintiffs had to do with one entity loaning money to the CJ fund for the use of another entity. But at the shareholder level, all of, if you are a member, and the membership, by the way, and I hate to add this complication, is not common. And you see the different memberships described in Exhibit 1.
They're not equal. They're not equal.
That, right. So a member of Company A may not be a member of Company B. But what the allegations are is that Company A wrongfully lent money to Company B. All of the shareholders of Company A were treated equally with regard to that transaction.
What does that matter, though, under the Medtronic case, though?
With regard to Medtronic, what Medtronic does with regard to analyzing whether a claim is direct or derivative focuses the injury on whether it happened at the corporate level or the individual level. And Medtronic says in footnote 5, I believe it's page 409 of the opinion, specifically adopts Wesson and says that when the injury is occurring at the common level, at the corporate level, the remedial provisions of the organizational statutes do not supplant the derivative pleading requirements of 23.09.
Does the fact that the plaintiffs here have alleged in 11G that the culpable defendants have maliciously reduced or eliminated distributions to the plaintiffs and non-culpable defendants change that, since it's an assertion of direct, it seems to me, harm, as opposed to harm to the entities themselves?
It's not an assertion of direct harm. It's an assertion of intent, but the distributions were not provided at the corporate level. So, for example, if Jay Mutchler is an owner of the entity that did not receive distributions, he did not receive distributions. There is no allegation that any particular shareholder was treated more favorably or less favorably than another.
I don't see that distinction in Medtronic, either in the Court of Appeals decision that we issued or in the Medtronic decision. And in fact, I think it is somewhat contrary to the Wesson decision. When you actually look at the facts between the two, I think Medtronic made it clear it doesn't matter if you have either a group of shareholders that are treated differently with respect to a dilution of their shares or the entire set of shareholders. I think Medtronic makes very, very clear, both at the Court of Appeals level and to the extent it was affirmed on appeal by the Supreme Court, that that injury is a direct claim when you've got dilution of shares to reduction in the in or dilution of the shares to the shareholders. That then inures to the benefit or detriment of the shareholders.
Well, I do agree with that, Your Honor, that Medtronic is specifically discussing dilution and whether corporate decisions are impacting a particular shareholder. We don't have allegations of dilution in this case.
Why don't we? It seems that we do in G. Seems that's specifically one of the allegations, isn't it?
Your Honor, there's not an allegation that any particular member has had their ownership interest lessened by any decision-making by any of the defendants in this case.
But G says maliciously reducing or eliminating distributions to plaintiffs and the non-culpable defendants.
Your Honor, with regard to the distributions, that wouldn't impact the ownership interest. It simply has to do with corporate decision-making as to whether or not to use money to distribute to the members or to use that money in some other manner.
Right, but that would affect the shareholders, whether they receive the distributions or not.
That's true, Your Honor, but that is simply...
So the injury is to the shareholders, and any benefit would go to the shareholders as well.
The fact of the distribution would, in fact, go... I mean, that is something that the shareholder would receive, but it is a decision that's made at the corporate level with regard to the use of an asset.
But the Medtronic analysis, it doesn't matter who makes the decision. What we're looking at in that two-pronged Medtronic test is who would be injured and who would receive the recovery. It seems that the distributions, the injured party would be the shareholders, and the recovery would go to the shareholders. They're the ones who would get the check. They're the ones who would receive the distributions. Let me ask you this. Distributions, who are they paid to?
Distributions are paid to the shareholders, okay. But there's no entitlement to distributions.
I understand that. There's no entitlement to that. But they're the ones who would be injured, right?
Well, I wouldn't call it an injury, Your Honor, and I would disagree.
If you're a shareholder and you don't get a check that you think you're going to get, I think you would say that would be an injury to you, right?
Well, I think the way that I would define a distribution is a decision as to how the company is going to spend its money.
That's a different issue. I think the issue under Medtronic is who would be injured, and we have to take the allegations as in the complaint. We have to assume that they're true, right?
Well, that's true, Your Honor, but I would disagree that the decision to make a distribution amounts to an injury without some underlying wrongful conduct.
Well, that's what's alleged, though, maliciously reducing or eliminating distributions. And we have to take that allegation as true. So we have to assume that the respondents maliciously reduced or eliminated the distributions to the plaintiffs. So that the only question for us is two-pronged. If that is true, which we must assume, who is the injured party and who would receive the recovery?
And, Your Honor, I believe that allegation sounds in the tone of corporate waste.
How?
Or misappropriation, because it is an allegation about the manner in which the corporation's money was spent at the corporate level. If the pleading was that the plaintiffs did not receive distributions, that would be a direct claim, Your Honor.
That's what's pleaded in 11G.
I'm sorry. If the plaintiffs received the distributions and other shareholders, the plaintiffs did not receive distributions, the other shareholders did.
Right, but if you read 11C and 11G together, that seems to be what is perhaps inartfully pleaded.
I don't believe it is, Your Honor. I believe that the allegation is that no distributions were issued to any shareholder.
Well, it says reduced or eliminated. It doesn't say no. It said either they were reduced or they were eliminated.
Correct, Your Honor. But the allegations in the case are all occurring, again, at the corporate level. There's no allegation that any shareholder was treated more favorably than another.
Well, I think your dichotomy between some being treated differently than others is one that was explicitly rejected in Medtronic, first of all. And second of all, the idea of reading corporate waste into this, I don't see that language in here at all. I understand your arguments in terms of the other ones.
Right.
But in that one, I don't see that at all. And unlike the other allegations, this one has no reference whatsoever to, quote unquote, the entities as that's defined. This only talks about plaintiffs and non-culpable defendants.
Your Honor, as I understand the allegations, they are about what happened at the corporate level and whether or not distributions were issued to all of the members equally. The allegation is, in essence, that the company decided to spend its money elsewhere. And we believe that is a corporate-level derivative claim, even though the distribution itself would be received by the individual. It is only their membership interest that is defining any right to the prorated distribution. I believe that Medtronic does, in fact, answer the question of whether or not, again, this equitable relief is subject to the derivative claims, and it is that they look to the theory in which the claim is couched, but not to the theory, excuse me, but to the injury itself.
You only have about a minute left.
Yes.
Just switching gears quickly, why isn't the claims, I believe it's counts 4 through 7, why isn't that enough? And we're just notice pleading state. We don't require, unless it's a fraud claim or something else, statute, as you know. Why isn't enough just to say that claims or the contracts have been breached and list out the names of the various contracts?
Well, with regard to the remedial functions, I believe that more specific pleading is required. With regard to the breach, this is a notice pleading state. Your Honor, I believe that the easiest way to affirm dismissal is simply to find that those contracts are, again, making allegations at the corporate level. They are derivative claims. All of the underlying facts are alleging behavior that is occurring at the corporate level, not at the individual level. And there's no allegation of any individual right that was breached as a result of the contract.
Can I ask you this? Can I ask one more question? Why wouldn't reducing or eliminating distributions to shareholders to further the culpable defendant's self-dealing on commingling of money, I mean, why wouldn't that state a claim of frustration of a shareholder's reasonable expectations under the 302A and 322 statutory schemes?
It may be a claim that can be brought under 302A.751, but because it's occurring at the corporate level, 23.09 also must be applied. Again, the misappropriation is occurring through the use of the corporate funds, the alleged misappropriation. And if, in fact, alleged misappropriation is exhausting assets of the company, which prevents distributions, that's a derivative claim. Again, it all is flowing from the ownership interest, not from any individual right. I know my time is up, Your Honors, if you have any other questions.
Thank you,
Your Honor.
Excuse me. Your Honors, just briefly, I didn't talk about the counts 4 through 7 dismissal, and I know Your Honors were asking some questions about that. I believe our positions are adequately briefed, and it's a fairly straightforward issue. I would point out, though, that we have our sua sponte argument and all that, but the district court, the only basis that the defendants moved for dismissal under Rule 12 was that all the claims were derivative. And the district court did not decide that issue with regard to counts 4 through 7. And it seems to me that this court, under a well-established precedent, could either refuse to hear that issue because it wasn't dealt with in the trial court, or exercise its discretion to go ahead and decide whether those claims are derivative or not. And I think we had indicated that in our briefing.
Our review of that issue would be de novo in any event.
It's our position it would. I don't think anybody has contested there's anything other than a de novo standard of review that the court is applying to any of the dismissal that occurred. And Your Honors, I probably should have been a little more careful in responding to Judge Bjorkman's questions earlier about, you know, what did we plead? Did we plead direct harm? And I think Your Honors were picking up on the fact that if you look at the complaint as a whole, what we have here is a self-dealing situation that is causing economic harm and other functional harm to the plaintiffs. The functional harm in terms of our allegations of deadlock. Deadlock is a specific non-economic injury that can be remedied by a forced buyout, a forced sale, or a dissolution, or any other equitable relief the district court sees fit to apply to remedy that problem. That is not all that different than frustration of reasonable expectations of a shareholder, like in the Lund case where Ms. Lund wanted to exit. And Judge Reyes, you had asked earlier about you pointed out and seemed to credit a respondent's argument that resolutions aren't contracts. I would submit that the Minnesota law is not clear on that point. That may well be the case, and the court may well think that they're not contracts. But even if they aren't, if you look at the type of proof in these minority shareholder cases where the reasonable expectations doctrine is being analyzed, those reasonable expectations, the proof in those cases, and the Lund case is a good example of that, can be oral communications, they can be emails. And, you know, with notice pleading, you don't have to plead them at that level. But here, we had resolutions, and we allege these resolutions were agreed to by all the parties to stop this cookie jar commingling involving millions of dollars that were furthering self-dealing. That self-dealing allegation does, even though Medtronic doesn't require disparate harm anymore after the Court of Appeals decision and the Supreme Court decision, we still have frustration of reasonable expectations. That proof can be wide-ranging, it can be very informal, it can be testimonial in nature. And it's our submission, Your Honor, that the resolutions as part of that mix. And if the court were to look at the file, I know we're testing the complaint, these resolutions were front and center, a huge issue in the injunction motion, where Mr. Mutchler promised he would stop commingling the money.
In terms of our standard of review, we're looking at the Rule 12 dismissal. Are the filings in connection with the injunction motion part of our record when we're looking at the issue of Rule 12 dismissal?
To the extent the complaint refers to resolutions generally, and the actual resolutions were submitted in the injunction motion, I think that they are part of the record, Your Honor, in the sense that it's a document that is explicitly referred to in the complaint. So I think the court would have discretion as to whether to look outside the four corners of the complaint, because obviously if the court were to determine that the complaint either states or doesn't state a claim on its four corners, I think it is appropriate to look at documents that are referenced in the complaint that are part of the court record that everybody knows about. It's not like it's a secret, to further the analysis if the court thinks that's appropriate. I see my time is up. Any questions?
No.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you both, counsel, for your oral arguments and briefing. Both were very well done. We will be issuing an order within the 90-day statutory time frame. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.